Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Yes, good evening. Welcome to tonight's Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation author event. Thank you all so much for being here. My name is Daniel Blank, and I'm the Managing Director of Public Programs at the Foundation, where, among other roles, I lead this acclaimed author event series. And as I've often said, some of you have heard me say this already so far this season, this series is one of this city's great cultural treasures. By bringing authors together with readers, we create a space for engaging conversations, for exciting conversations, and we make the literary world, and tonight the artistic world, accessible to the Philadelphia community. Before we get to tonight's program, I want to say just a few quick words about our organization. The Foundation works to expand the Free Library's programming and advance its mission of promoting literacy throughout the Philadelphia region. But as a nonprofit, we are reliant upon your support to achieve these goals. So please do consider donating most easily through our website, freelibrary.org. And I see some patrons and some regular supporters in the audience. We are especially grateful, and a special welcome to you. If you're interested in joining one of our membership programs, the Pepper Society for our most loyal donors, the Raven Society for young professionals, or the Knee High Society for families with children 12 and under, you can find more information on our website. Tonight we welcome Myra Kalman, who is the author-illustrator of over 30 books for adults and children. She has contributed numerous pieces to the New York Times and the New Yorker. She has collaborated with, among others, David Byrne, Isaac Mizrahi, Mark Morris, Michael Pollan, and, unbeknownst to Gertrude Stein, Gertrude Stein. She has had numerous exhibitions, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City and the ICA in Philadelphia. Her artwork is represented by the Mary Ryan Gallery in New York, where the paintings from Still Life with Remorse are being exhibited until November 30th. She will be joined in conversation by Alex Connor, the owner and director of Commonweal, a four-year-old commercial gallery that exhibits Philadelphia-based artists whose works engage with critical dialogues that thoughtfully reflect the capacities of our shared human experience. Over the past 16 years, he has worked as a curator, writer, organizer, and educator at organizations such as the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Barnes Foundation, and Philly Stewards, among others. We are clearly in for a very good conversation tonight, and we're thrilled to have such a terrific crowd here. Please join me in welcoming Myra Kalman and Alex Connor.
Remorse.
Let's get into it. But before we get into it, I know that there's something you wanted to start out with, which is maybe a bit of a way to get there, a map of sorts.
Yes, and I apologize ahead of time for those of you who have seen it, because I'm compelled to show this map every time I speak. This is a map of the United States that my mother made. Oh, wait, you have to go back. Okay. When I was doing the And the Pursuit of Happiness for the New York Times, I was asking people to make maps of the United States from memory. And everybody I asked did a very earnest and boring job. And the only person who did something completely crazy and completely interesting was my mother. So you can see, obviously, there's no sanity at all involved, and no sense of geography, and no understanding of anything. And saying, sorry, the rest unknown, thank you. Which I've always said is, sorry, the rest unknown, you could go to hell, I couldn't care less. And I just want to say that that's an extraordinary person to grow up with, because the point is, you don't have to get it right, you just have to try to get it, whatever it is for you. And that's a very big distinction, because there's so much one doesn't know. So much. More than knowing. I know not much more than I know, of course. I mean, we all do. So that's Sarah Berman's map.
Wonderful. And so this map has inspired a lot of your writings and thinking about writing and thinking about subject matters, because I know you have another book that you published very recently, Women Holding Things, which I think might be the...
Right. The next slide is Women slide. Holding Things, which should be the next image. There we are. And so the women in my family, my mother is a great example, but the women in my family were very strong. Nobody had any job. I mean, they worked like crazy all day long, but none of them had jobs, and none of them were artists. But in their way, they were artists, and they were very inspiring. So the stories and the legends and the sorrow and the joy, all stem from the family that I have and the stories that they told. So that's I keep writing about that over and over again.
Well... first off, thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's really exciting to have you here, and I'm very excited to be able to speak with you about your newest book, which I know we have out in the lobby, but I'll share right here if you haven't seen it yet. Still Life with Remorse, Family Stories, which is what we are referring to. Oh, lovely, up on there. And so one thing that I wanted to ask you about, Myra, was in 2010, you published a book called And the Pursuit of Happiness, which looked at American democracy over the course of a year during an election period. It was very different in content and approach. But I noticed that in both that book and this one, you centered kind of an emotional state, happiness and remorse. And I wanted to ask if you felt there was a connection between these two books, or how using that as a jumping off point kind of inspired you to be able to share your stories.
Well, I've discovered... as I get older and the years go by, that I've honed in on remorse, and I've also honed in on happiness, that they're inextricable. You can't have one without the other. Not only you can't have one without the other, you can't have them at separate times, which is disconcerting and actually incredibly exhausting. But I was looking up nervous exhaustion on the train down, thinking, I must have every symptom of that. And it's neurasthenia, which I didn't know what that was. And then they say to you, I say, okay, what are the cures for neurasthenia? Try to relax. And I thought, okay, that's good. So get some sleep, but be active. It's completely, you could have another nervous breakdown trying to read the things about how to get over a nervous breakdown. But so I think that the way that I look at the world and the work that I do is bound up with the sense of that through you're navigating the world, you're going through the day, you're besieged by emotion, a roller coaster of emotion, some more, for some of us more or less, and that you have to reconcile in your head that this is not only it's part of life, it's an essential part of life, and to not to be fazed. There was also on the train, there was a great billboard that said, chill out and eat a pickle. Maybe some of you know it. And I thought, oh my God, that's such great advice. That's after I read the neurasthenia thing. I thought, just eat a pickle. So, the veering between serious and humor is, it's lightning.
I think that's a good thing for all of us to remember, for sure. And, one thing that I found when reading this book, which is filled with a number of, I believe what you refer to as short stories.
Light as a souffle.
Well, I love that description, too, because, there are some absolutely hilarious moments in it where, I chuckled out loud when you pondered if in a past life you were the 19th century painter Eugene Delacroix.
But may have been.
May
I
have
couldn't
been.
Rule it out.
Yes. Yeah. I couldn't rule it out. Yes, that's exactly the line. It's like you wrote it. And then, in other places, there's the story of your father's cousin with the crooked finger, which left me absolutely destitute. And I will not ruin it for the crowd because it was a gut punch. But really, I think what this book does is it pulls out the nuance of remorse. And I was interested if in writing it, your relationship with remorse changed or grew or in any way fluctuated?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that before I started writing, and the reason I started writing about it in the first place was because everything I read, the only word that I saw was remorse. And everything that people were saying, the only word I heard was remorse. So clearly something was on my mind and penetrating. And then I thought, well, isn't it funny? Because I have no remorse. And then I thought, that's insane. I have, you know, like 5 minutes later, I collapsed with remorse. And more memories, more unwanted memories of horrible things that I'd done. So I thought that it would be a catharsis. I didn't think it would be a catharsis to write, because there's no such thing. I just, now I even have more. Literally. And then now I'm spending time trying to kind of absolve myself and then say, that's the big question. Whatever you've done in your life, could you do it differently? Would you do it differently? And how could you do it differently if that's what it was? So then you have to say, we're all a mix of these extraordinary memories. And I'll probably, as I said, I'm probably doing something right now that I will have remorse for, you know, tomorrow. And I say, how could I have been so insensitive about X or Y or Z? Which is, you know, that's a minefield. So then you have to just, you know, go and eat a pickle. I mean, truly.
Well, I think that's a wonderful answer, and it's lovely to hear that. Yeah, I mean, it is something that is affecting to everybody, which is why I think this volume of short stories is so human and direct, and it felt very kind that you chose to share so many things that were so close to the bone with the reader through this book. And I don't mean to take a break, but I know we have wonderful images from the book, and maybe whoever's working the projector can slowly, yes, we can cycle through them, because I believe, yep.
Right. So the painting before was Cézanne's studio that I went to visit, and I didn't want to leave. They had to kind of like throw me out the door. And the recipe for the gray, in case you're interested, because the walls are painted gray and it's extraordinary. And it's a room that has the windows open, his coat is there, it's all covered with dust. It's really spectacular and hasn't been made sterile by, you know, some kind of committee to make something, you know, last. Anyway, the recipe for the gray is black, white, ochre, and ultramarine. Mm-hmm. Now, for those of you who need to know. And anybody who paints really needs to know. Anyway, so the next image is that is Mirandi's studio, and one of the conversations that I had that I have with myself is in choosing still lifes as a counterpoint to remorse. What's going on with a still life? You know, what kind of emotion is going on there? The relationship we have to the objects around us that we have that carry so many memories that we love. That we want to get rid of, that, you know, all of that we received as gifts, all the attachments that we have, and how they sit in a room, is really something quite extraordinary. So it's just looking at beauty too, you know, just saying plain old, could I do something that's beautiful? We don't know.
Okay. But you do start out the book by giving us a lovely little take, because there are a wonderful amount of still lifes and interiors in this book. And may I just read this very
sure.
briefly? So in the beginning, remorse, deep regret, implying shame, implying guilt, implying sorrow. In still lifes and interiors, there must be a certain amount of remorse lurking among the bowls of fruit, vases of flowers and objects scattered about the room. And I know that you, like I, are slightly object obsessed. I believe I have heard you have a collection of ladders. Is that correct?
Yes, but I've deaccessioned some, but I have kept the best.
But you have a fancy for sinks as well?
Yes, is painting sinks. I don't collect sinks, but I do have I do paintings of sinks.
So I guess because of that, the life of objects and the stories they hold, what brought you to choosing still lifes and interiors for this? You know, with that introduction, you kind of give us a little entryway, but could you speak more about that?
Well, I didn't want to do one painting after another of misery. I thought that would get that would get old really soon, and that I started the same way that I was hearing remorse. All of a sudden, my lens shifted to still lifes, and I would look at them much more closely than I ever did. I looked at the Chardin in the Frick and thought, "Well, I have to go to the Louvre and look at the Chardins there." And they're also, you know, upstairs where nobody goes, and you could just stare at the plums there forever. And so there's a tremendous amount of emotion in those, and it's also fun to try to paint a plum, or you know, or go to Cézanne's studio and what's you know this was somewhere in France, and you know, of course, Cézanne's cherries. We could stare at that painting for you know forever, and I guess there's a release. There's a kind of counterpoint of being entrenched in unsolvable confusion and release of something beautiful, like a vase of flowers, you know, which doesn't have anything necessarily sad about it. So it just gives you a moment to rest and a moment to contemplate, and then you can go on your merry way. Let's see what else we have here. Yeah, I think those are Matisse's objects from Matisse's studio.
One of the most interesting things I think about this book is in addition, I mean, it is subtitled Family Stories,
right.
But you bring in stories of so many other kind of creative individuals throughout history. Tolstoy is there, Chekhov's there, and music plays a really big
yeah.
part as well. I mean, there are two interludes in
there
this book.
There are two musical interludes because you need them.
Well, can you speak a little bit more about that?
Because you know what? I want to. Can I read this story?
Go for it.
This goes with my mother. This painting goes with the story about my mother, and I'll find it in an hour or two. We'll see. Here we go. I mean, you know, the thing about writing about family is that everybody is terrified to speak around you. Because there is nothing sacred. There's no story that anybody tells me in my family that I'm not going to write. I mean, unless I think it's really hurtful and I have to wait for them to die. Or they have to wait for me to die or something. But at any rate, but this is going far back. And then, of course, the other thing is, whose version of history is true? You know, I mean, absolutely, there is no truth. There's all kinds of, like, subjective emotion and misunderstandings and stuff like that. Okay. Sarah and Myra. When I was born, my mother became gravely ill. For 3 months, she lay in the hospital, hovering between life and death, delirious with raging fevers, unaware of my existence. My father, who loved grand gestures, made sure there were always flowers by her bed. I went to live with my grandparents. How could my father be expected to take care of a newborn baby? My aunt Shoshana and her family were also living with my grandparents, so my aunt also took care of me. I slept in a baby carriage and was parked for much of the day in the kitchen as they cooked the endless meals for the family. Every Friday, many cakes were baked. I must have been lying there, smelling all of those smells. They entered into me instead of my mother's milk. Of course, they took me out for strolls in the fresh air next to the sea. They must have pushed my carriage up and down the promenade, worrying and walking, walking and worried sick. Little by little, my mother recovered. She came home and life began, and she always walked very quickly, and I was always lagging behind her. So my parents' relationship was terrible, and you know, I talk about that, and the stories about how they got divorced after 38 years of marriage. Well, that's all. We don't have to go there now, right? So sad.
Yes, yes, very sad. But you know, in the sadness, as I kind of mentioned earlier, I think also finding a lot of the humor in family and in
yeah.
that sadness of family. And I think the way you play with memory and lack of solidity of that is really kind of fascinating. Did you, well, first off, have a lot of family members read this book?
Some family members have read it.
Okay. Positive response?
They're lawyering up.
Okay.
No. No, I mean, you know, I was reading a Natalia Ginsburg book on the way down here, the house in the city or the city in the house, I can't remember how it goes, but at any rate, in one of her books, I think it's Family Lexicon, she wrote an intro and said, and she was much, much more acerbic than I am, said, some family members may have an issue with something that I've written, well, that's their problem. That's what she says. So I keep thinking about that, saying how obliged are you to care about the feelings of the people around you? And, of course, the people that are, that you know, the Tolstoy family doesn't mind what I'm saying. I haven't heard from anybody in the Tolstoy family, but the night is young. We'll see. So far, so good.
Well, let's jump back to that, because I mentioned it earlier, and I think that was something that was really fascinating to me, was mixing in with family stories, the stories of these other writers and artists and musicians. And right. what was your, besides maybe loving their works, you know, right. What was the function of that for you in putting this book together?
Well, I think that I probably have a better relationship with dead writers than people in my family. I could say that's probably very true. And, you know, then I talk about, do I have a better relationship with objects than I do with, let's say, some of my relatives? And that's probably true also. So there are writers that I revere, and I can't stop mentioning them. So, of course, there's Kafka. And I have a great Kafka quote, which, there's a Kafka story where he and Mahler eat too much, and they feel very nauseous. But this is a wonderful Kafka quote. I have hardly anything in common with myself and should stand very quietly in a corner, content that I breathe. I mean, what more do you need to know than that? And his diaries were translated last year by Ross Benjamin. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. There isn't a moment that's rational. And at the same time, he was very prolific. I mean, even though he wanted everything burnt and asked Max Brod to do that. And then the interesting thing is that many people say that he asked the only person that he knew would not burn his work. So it's an interesting kind of a contradiction or conundrum. At any rate, so I love including Kafka in everything I do, and later we'll see me as Kafka, you know, in this insatiable attention, you know, need for attention in the limelight. And who else? Oh, I talk about, well, you know, there are Baudelaire and...
Proust?
Proust is number one, as we say. He's number one in our family. So I always say that I'd be in a mental institution if it weren't for Proust. Because I think any of you who've read a lot of Proust and who have become complete Proustians, as we say, without being lofty or scholarly, that there's some essential aspect of humanity in the books that does keep you able to go on. It sounds very tenuous, but it's, you know, I sound tenuous, but I'm not that tenuous.
Well,
somewhat.
That leads me on to a Proust quote. So in Pleasures and Regrets, he observes, "Let us be grateful to people who make us happy. They are the charming gardeners who make our souls blossom." Lovely. Contrasted with Jean-Paul Sartre's quote in the 1944 play No Exit, which popularly is, "Hell is other people." You know, often in these stories, it's difficult to tell when and how individuals are either the cause or the palliative to issues of remorse. And I think that's really, I think that was a really beautiful thing to kind of watch change throughout each short story. Do you feel they occupy both spaces, and is maybe that... is that binary that people can have in your life, the cause of remorse and the solution to it, something that was interesting to you?
It's completely the way it is. Because you can adore somebody, and then they say something incredibly hurtful. And then you go, well, where did that come from? I depend on them. They're my lifeline. So then you have to kind of recalibrate and adjust and say, And I don't know what. I mean, it's a complicated thing. I haven't figured it out. But I also want to say about Proust that one minute he would say, you know, everybody is wonderful. And the next minute he would say, everybody's horrible. I mean, he pulls the rug out every single time that he says something. So that's also another issue. But I think that, it's a fog of unknowing. I don't know how to, with shimmery clarity, popping up in between. You know, so today I had an image of myself on a farm feeding chickens with a bucket. And I thought, well, how am I going to get to a farm? Does anybody have a farm with chickens? You know, like, it seemed like the most real thing to me. Doing my work didn't seem real. You know, washing the dishes seemed real. But the most real thing was, yeah, aha, I must go to a farm, get a bucket, and feed chickens. So I don't hear anybody offering a chicken farm.
Well, we were talking about farms a little before we came out here. And I grew up on one, we have no chickens.
Yeah,
so
I was excited.
I was actually
going to say to you, like, when can we go to your chicken farm? But it's
different
not.
Different type of farm, right. No chickens. But that's so interesting. So that kind of displacement and thinking of yourself, those ideas that kind of take you away from everyday life, is that a form? Do you find that to be maybe a form of escapism or idealism or...
necessary escape. I just want to say that probably the source, but everybody has a source of grief. There's no such thing as not having some amount of grief in your life. That's not just the tangible grief, but the kind of the deeper grief that you got that's unspoken, that you have, that's a kind of dread that you don't understand where it came from. For my family, there's a lot of it from the displacement of coming from Belarus, going to Palestine. My father's family, didn't leave Belarus, and they were all killed. My mother's family also. Everybody who stayed behind, who said, what could possibly go wrong, was murdered. And so in my family, there was no certainty. There was no sense of danger not lurking. And... that's a true state for anybody. You know, anything can be completely destroyed overnight or in an hour. So I think that that's some kind of not belonging. But maybe everybody has their version of not belonging, or maybe, I don't know. So I think that also from coming from there to there to there, and also I think being an outsider is actually, for me, really wonderful. So I enjoy that position of observing and being outside.
I mean, I know there are quite a few short stories in here that really speak to that. Is there any in particular that you might like to read for us? Because...
I don't know what I chose. Let's see. Do you have something?
Moshe Ladizen.
I have Chekhov's Dead in here. That's one of my favorite paintings. But well...
Is Moshele a family member? Because you never quite tell us 100%. He's a son of Fanny, but I don't know who Fanny is.
Yeah, that's a sad story. Okay.
Well,
also I want to say the reason that there are musical interludes in this, as you asked before, is that I listen to music all day long, and that the inability to speak, which I end the book by saying, you know, let's not talk, let's just sing, that the inability to speak is real. And as Nietzsche said, a day without dancing is a wasted day. I think that dancing, can you imagine him saying that? He did. But this is Moshele Dies in Palestine. Moshele was the son of Fanny. He was killed in the War of Independence. He was only 17. He was killed by the British. His mother could not cry. Everyone said to her, cry, Fanny. The worst has happened to you. Cry. But she couldn't cry. The entire city followed the funeral for Moshele. His body was in a jeep. Fanny spoke to her dead son. Maybe you will get up. She was heartbroken, never having said a good word to him when he was alive. And, you know, that's... obviously, we have people in our lives who we could have been... kinder to, show of hands, but no. But if you think about it, you go back and you say, well, how could I be, you know, that's always such a question, you know, that does it inform going forward? Does what you've looked back on in your life inform how you will be? And I think it's hopeless.
Well, there is that saying that it's not a mistake if you learn from it. So
yeah, but what do you learn? I mean, that's the thing. How do you know that you've learned? And as I say, how do I know that something I've done today was, I thought was cheerio and actually was not, because I was, you know, selfish or horrible or something. So,
well, much like I won't ask you to read it, but there's a wonderful short story about a dinner party, and right. being at a dinner party and saying something and wounding someone, and having someone else wound you, and you leave the party, not knowing how you got wounded or how
yeah,
the other person.
Yeah, I hate dinner parties. I really do, because just for that reason, because you have to sit at a table and it's nighttime, which I told you I don't like, and then you have to go around and around, and you have to keep talking and keep talking and keep talking. For what, 2 hours, 3 hours? It's bound to become a disaster.
You do put a footnote on that short story, though, that says there are good dinner
there
parties.
There are good dinner parties, but they're few and far between. Better to have breakfast. Stick with breakfast. You can get up and leave. I wanted to read... Hold on a second. I mean, I had a section about, you know, let me read something, this quick thing here, if I can find it. Okay. So when I was getting towards the end of this book, and, you know, there are wars, and there's anxiety, and there's the future, and what's going to happen, and everybody is really, really crazed in many, many ways. So this is what I wrote. Everything. Everything is perfect. Everything is good. Everything is in its place. Everything is mended. There is nothing left to mend. Everything is washed, folded, ironed, put away in neat stacks. There is lavender in the drawers, and the drawers open easily. That's a big one. Everything is done. Everything is sorted out, cleaned, polished, put away. Everything is finished, and there is nothing left to say. There is nothing left to say or do but sit quietly in the middle of the room and look at the vase, flowers, and books. And yet, everything is a mess. Everything is undone. Everything is broken. Everyone is sad. Everyone is depressed. Everything is hopeless. Everyone is desperate. Everyone is wrapped in malaise. A dense blanket of malaise covers everyone on earth. And yet, everyone continues to live. Everyone reconsiders despair. Everyone starts to have a good time. Everyone starts to enjoy life. And then I go on and I tell a few more sad stories. And then... then we
but
get to the
but
end.
But that one, that poem, that short story ends with.
And yet.
I think that's such a beautiful way, because it's moving on to this idea that's a rhythm of life.
Yeah.
I thought that was such a beautiful poem. Everything, it does sum up a lot of the book. And I will reiterate to the crowd, there are very funny moments in this book.
And I also, it's hilarious. And I also want to say, I have a million beautiful, happy moments during the day. Just, one couldn't happen without the other, obviously. And there has to be humor in it. And I'll just tell you quickly, one of the favorite stories of my family is that in Belarus, one of the cousins was sitting in a shack, and he was drinking a glass of tea, and a bolt of lightning shot through the window and killed him. And my family thinks that's the funniest story. That you can see the humor in that, right? So, I mean, the irony.
Well,
just about to enjoy a nice glass of tea, but that's how it is, isn't it? So.
Well, and to that point, because you know, when we were speaking backstage, you said, "You've had enough of remorse now. We've had remorse, and so your next two books, one is looking at." Joy.
Yeah. I mean, after remorse, how could you not go to joy? Yeah.
And is that taking those story, that similar stories of the bolt of lightning and just wrapping it under the joy umbrella?
Right. I don't know if I could manage that. I mean, this book, Joy, it's going to be a little booklet. And I have to say that I work a lot with my son, Alex Gallman, who has a museum in a defunct elevator shaft on Cortland Alley in New York, and shows ephemera of our, like, kind of social anthropology of our world. And we installed the reproduction of my mother's closet, Sarah Berman's closet, in that alleyway. And then it went to the Met. So my mother's, her closet of bras and underpants and other things went to the Metropolitan, which we thought was pretty fabulous and the right thing to have happen. But so we were talking. So he designs all my books, and he's really my editor and my colleague. And so we were talking about what would come next, and he said, "Could we have a little joy?" You know. So the next book is Joy, and then the next book after that is Trees. And I thought, kind of, I don't read the paper, I don't watch the news because life is short, and I don't want to waste any time. So I thought that wandering around gardens for the next few years is the ticket, in case it's not so pleasant, you know. So anyway, so Joy and Trees.
To your collaborations with your son, which I think is wonderful, and Sarah Berman's closet, her mother's closet, did go to the Met in 2017, which is an.
I didn't know that. It's funny.
I did some research. But you've also been doing videos,
yes,
for this book. So these are kind of 3-minute clips, and the one you have here tonight is for Clara Schumann.
Yes. So we have. So, as I said, in the need to be in the spotlight, I decided. We have some images before that. I don't know whether. Don't show the movie yet. Whatever you do, could you go back? Can you go back, or is it impossible to go back? Keep going after the end. Oh,
I think it was slide 21.
I mean, we could start. Can you? There. Okay. Thank you. So then the next one, the next image. So I decided that it would be nice to be Martha Graham. She's not in the book, but I saw a video of her doing Frontier, and I thought, how hard could that be? How hard could a Martha Graham choreography be? So I tried that. Don't try that at home. And then the next person I am, so we're doing short videos of these, is Cicero, because he's in the book, and he had a bad relationship with Cleopatra, as many of you know. And then the next character is Kafka, who has a little shop that I run, that he runs. And then the next one is a little film of Clara Schumann. So we're showing you a sneak peek of the film, and the other three are in process, and we're editing them for, you know, we don't know what. We hope.
Wonderful.
For something. Yeah. It's a work in process. It's a work in progress. It's still, we're still editing, but you get the gist.
I've never heard Swedish Fish sung so lovingly. Yes, I think now we have time for questions. So do we have any questions in the crowd? You can just raise your hand and we will call on you. It's a small enough group. Anybody have any? Oh, we have somebody down in front, and I think you're close enough if you just want to share it out.
I'm wondering what your medium is. Is it gouache?
Yeah, I paint in gouache on paper.
Any other questions? Oh, we have one right over here.
So, am I overthinking it?
Yes. I never thought of that. I'm very literal. Now I will. Now I'll think about that. Yeah.
So, which came first, the painting or the story, or did it move all around?
Which came first, the painting or the story?
Yeah. Which came first, the painting or the story?
Well, the nice thing about my job, as I say, I wake up in the morning and I go out for a walk and I don't know what I'm going to see, but I see wonderful things that I know I want to paint. So those, capturing those moments of, that's my job, capturing those beautiful moments that I love or funny moments. And then there are also stories that are kind of rambling through my head, and they go back and forth. I write for paintings and I paint for writing. So it's not just one linear thing.
Oh, we have a friend over on the left.
It's okay, I can just yell. Can you and your son divvy up the work?
We want to make sure
you both do the same thing
for the recording. People can hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. You and your son, how do you work together? Do you both write? Do you both paint? What's the relationship?
I thought you were going to ask, how do we divvy up the money? Which That's a conversation. But he's not here to defend himself. No, he edits and he designs. He doesn't do the writing or the painting. That's my job. But there's a lot of conversation that we have along the way about the flow of it and the editing. You know, there are many drafts that we go through and a million different iterations of it until we're both happy. So it's just a really lovely conversation. And we both have a similar sense of humor. He was born to me and, you know, would have been ejected from the home. And, you know, he has a sister who also has a good sense of humor. So I think that that language is something that it's shorthand for us. So it's really good. And he thinks about a lot of things that, and I'm lazier than he is, so that's good.
We have somebody right here in the center. We have to wait for the recording. Passing down for posterity.
Did this project grow out of women holding things, or was it developed concurrently? Because I was very moved by that book, and there's like a small, digression, or the biggest digression is about your family, and it's almost like this book expands on it.
I'm sorry.
It almost seemed like a follow-up, and I'm curious if it was developed concurrently or sequentially.
Well, you know, it came afterwards, but I think that what happened with women holding things, with remorse, was that I had more to say. I had more stories to tell. So that women holding things was the first round, and then I thought, well, I think I want to do more writing than painting. And so that was the motivator. I wasn't thinking about it when I was doing Women Holding Things, but afterwards it became an obvious next step. Like joy is the obvious next step after remorse, which was my son's idea. Yeah. So.
Also, as a follow-up, you write at the end of Women Holding Things that the next thing will be letting women letting go.
Ah.
And I'm waiting for that one too.
I'm not going to do that. So, I said that with no. With no truth at all.
We have a question. I can just pass my mic down. I mean, if that's easier.
Yep. There you are.
Any children's books in the works?
Any children's books in the works? Not at all. I write an illustrated letter to my granddaughters every week. That's so I'm giving them a future book deal. That's the next children's book.
Oh, we have a question right here.
The hat in Clara Schumann, you created that in your imagination and also built it?
Well, the hat, the first hat I bought, the black and white one, but the second hat, the fringe hat, I was thinking about doing a book about hats and shoes, which I may one day, and I have incredible imagery of, so that's a real hat, that a beautiful young woman named Clara Gaynor made. She made all the costumes. And even though it looks like I was playing the piano, and I can play badly, but that was Andrew Farrah Colton who recorded the Brahms, and it's a Brahms intermezzo. By the way, so Clara, which probably Brahms wrote for Clara. Yeah.
Hi, I loved your installation at the ICA, and I'm wondering if you have any more installations coming up.
Well, you know, it's funny because the store in the Kafka, you don't see that, but there's a shop that we created for Kafka, and I think of that as an installation, and maybe that'll be something somewhere. You know, I like the idea, but there aren't any installations in the works now.
And is your son involved with the installations, or is that just you?
Was he involved beforehand? You mean in
like the ICA?
The ICA? No.
Oh, it was wonderful.
He was too young. No, he was, I don't know, he wasn't part of that.
Okay, it was great.
I would be remiss, though, not to mention that running currently through November 30th at Mary Ryan Gallery is an exhibition of the paintings in this book. So if you were able to get up there, the gouache on papers are visible, their own kind of installation.
Hello. I know your work through, was introduced to your work through Max. So I was wondering if perhaps those books might serve as children's books in a way. And I also wanted to ask, why trees?
Why trees? Oh my gosh. Because trees are, I say that things that are a salvation in this world that keep you sane and happy are, music, one, books are another, and walking and all the things that are connected to walking. But looking at trees is one of the great things of solace in the world, and I guess I'm obviously solace needy. I mean, I don't know anybody who isn't, but I'm going to say that I have a lot of solace need, and so there's never a moment. I mean, you can the trees are just there. It's it's like animals. They're not talking. They're incredibly loving in many ways, and they offer you, and they have birds in them. And they're outside, and there are people maybe nearby. I mean, they have everything that you could possibly want, and they tell stories. So, and it's an excuse to not talk, which is excellent. Even though I enjoyed speaking to you tonight.
Because I brought both of my daughters up reading your books. Hey Willie was our favorite from the word go. And I loved it too. They're both in their 30s, so we didn't have a whole lot to, we had some Dr. Seuss and this and that. But your imagery, your words, your beautiful illustrations and your fantasy really meant so much to me and both of my daughters. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We have time for one more question. Does anyone want to close us out? Oh, we have one right here. Oh, it is hard to see. We have one right in the center that I caught that hand first.
I noticed that all of these paintings are kind of, they have a border built into them. They're kind of like self-contained in an edge, all the paintings that were shown tonight.
I'm sorry, it's like I'm a deaf person. No,
all the paintings have an edge. Where the edge
have an edge, right, have a natural edge.
Yeah, yeah. What's up with that?
No, it's where the painting ends. That note, we shall. No,
on
what
that
do you think
note,
on that
yes.
Note?
Well,
thank
can
you
we
very
all
much.
Have? Can we have
thank
a round
you.
Of applause for Myra Callen for coming this evening? Thank you.